screeched and laughed in the back of it. Okay, suppose my name isn't cleared and we never find the real murderer. What's the next best-case scenario? Me, always running, always hiding? That'll be my life. For all I know, I will have to go live with the keepers.
I don't think it'll come to that, said Dimitri. Abe and Sydney would help you find someplace safe.
Is there a safe place? For real? Adrian said the Guardians are increasing their efforts to find us. They've got the alchemists and probably human authorities looking for us, too. No matter where we go, we'll run the risk of being spotted. Then we'll have to move on. It'll be like that forever.
You'll be alive, he pointed out. That's what matters. Enjoy what you have. Every little detail of wherever you are. Don't focus on where you aren't.
Yeah, I admitted, trying to follow his advice. The sky seemed a little bluer, the birds a little louder. I suppose I shouldn't whine over the dream places I won't get to see. I should be grateful I get to see anything at all, and that I'm not living in a cave. He glanced over at me and smiled, something unreadable in his eyes.
Where do you want to go?
What, right now? I glanced around, sizing up our options. There was a bait and tackle store, a drug store, and an ice cream parlor. I had a feeling that last one would be a necessary trip before leaving town.
No, in the world.
I eyed him warily. Sydney's going to be pissed if we take off for Istanbul or something. This got me full-fledged laughter.
Not what I had in mind. Come on.
I followed him toward what looked like the bait and tackle store, and then noticed a small building tucked behind it. Naturally, his sharp eyes had seen what I missed, probably because I'd been fixated on the ice cream. Rubiesville Public Library.
Whoa, hey, I said.
One of the few perks of graduating was avoiding places like this.
It's probably air-conditioned,
he pointed out. I looked down at my sweat-soaked tank top and noticed a faint pink tinge to my skin. With my tanned complexion, I rarely burned, but this was some serious sun, even so late in the day. Lead on, I told him. The library was mercifully cool, though even smaller than the one at St. Vladimir's. With some uncanny sense, or maybe just a knowledge of the Dewey Decimal System, Dimitri led us over to the travel section, which consisted of about 10 books, three of which were about West Virginia. He frowned.
Not quite what I expected.
He scanned the shelf twice and then pulled out a large, bright-colored one entitled 100 Best Places to Visit in the World. We sat down cross-legged on the floor, and he handed me the book.
No way, comrade, I said. I know books are a journey of the imagination, but I don't think I'm up for that today.
Just take it, he said. Close your eyes and flip randomly to a page.
It seemed silly considering everything else going on in our life, but his face said he was serious. Indulging him, I closed my eyes and selected a page in the middle. I opened to it.
Mitchell, South Dakota? I exclaimed.
Remembering I was in a library, I lowered my voice.
Out of all the places in the world, that makes the top 100?
He was smiling again, and I'd forgotten how much I'd missed that.
Read it.
Located 90 minutes outside of Sioux Falls, Mitchell is home to the Corn Palace. I looked up at him in disbelief.
Corn Palace?
He scooted over next to me, leaning close to look at the pictures.
I figured it'd be made of corn husks, he noted.
The pictures actually showed what looked like a Middle Eastern, or even Russian-style building with turrets and onion domes.
Me too.
Reluctantly, I added, I'd visit it. I bet they have great t-shirts.
And?
He said, a sly look in his eyes.
I bet no guardians would look for us there.
I made no attempts to conceal my laughter, imagining us living as fugitives in the Corn Palace for the rest of our lives. My amusement brought us a scolding from a librarian, and we quieted as Dimitri took his turn. São Paulo, Brazil. Then my turn, Honolulu, Hawaii. Back and forth we passed the book, and before long, we were both lying on the floor, side by side, sharing mixed reactions as we continued our global tour of the imagination, our arms and legs just barely touched. If anyone had told me 48 hours ago that I'd be lying in a library with Dimitri, reading a travel book, I would have said they were crazy. Almost as crazy was the realization that I was doing something perfectly ordinary and casual with him. Since the moment we'd met, our lives had been about secrecy and danger. And really, those were still the dominant themes in our lives. But in those quiet couple of hours, time seemed to stand still. We were at peace. We were friends. Florence, Italy, I read. Pictures of elaborate churches and galleries filled the page. Sydney wants to go there. She wanted to study there, actually. If Abe could have managed that, I think she would have served him for life.
She's still pretty obedient, Dimitri remarked. I don't know her well, but I'm pretty sure Abe's got something on her.
He got her out of Russia, back to the U.S. He shook his head.
It's got to be more than that. Alchemists are loyal to their order. They don't like us. She hides it. They're trained to. But every minute with the Keepers is agony. For her to help us and betray her superiors, she owes him for some serious reason.
We both paused a moment, wondering what mysterious arrangement my father had with her.
It's irrelevant, though. She's helping us, which is what matters. And we should probably get back to her.
I knew he was right, but hated to go. I wanted to stay here, in this illusion of tranquility and safety, letting myself believe I might really make it to the Parthenon or even the Corn Palace someday. I handed the book back to him. One more. He picked his random page and opened the book. His smile fell.
St. Petersburg.
A weird mix of feelings entangled themselves in my chest. Nostalgia, because the city was beautiful. Sorrow, because my visit had been tainted by the awful task I'd gone there to do. Dimitri stared at the page for a long time, wistfulness on his face. It occurred to me then that, despite his earlier pep talk, he had to be experiencing what I did for Montana. Our old favorite places were lost to us now. I nudged him gently. Hey, enjoy where you're at, remember? Not where you can't go. He reluctantly shut the book and dragged his eyes away from it.
How'd you get so wise?
He teased. I had a good teacher. We smiled at each other. Something occurred to me. All this time, I'd figured he'd helped break me out because of Lissa's orders. Maybe there was more to it. Is that why you escaped with me? I asked. To see what parts of the world he could? His surprise was brief.
You don't need me to be wise, Rose. You're doing fine on your own. Yes, that was part of it. Maybe I would have been welcomed back eventually. But there was the risk I wouldn't. After being Strogoi.
He stumbled over the words a little.
I gained a new appreciation for life. It took a while. I'm still not there. We're talking about focusing on the present, not the future. But it's my past that haunts me. Faces. Nightmares. But the farther I get from that world of death, the more I want to embrace life. The smell of these books and the perfume you wear. The way the light bends through that window. Even the taste of breakfast with the Keepers.
You're a poet now.
No, just starting to realize the truth. I respect the law and the way our society runs. But there was no way I could risk losing life in some cell after only just finding it again. I wanted to run, too. That's why I helped you. That end.
What? I studied him, desperately wishing he wasn't so good at keeping emotions off his face. I knew him well. I understood him. But he could still hide things from me. He sat up, not meeting my eyes.
It doesn't matter. Let's go back to Sydney and see if she found out anything. Although, as much as I hate to say it, I think it's unlikely.
I know. I stood with him, still wondering what else he would have said. She probably gave up and started playing Minesweeper. We headed back toward the cafe, stopping briefly for ice cream. Eating it while we walked proved quite the challenge. The sun was nearing the horizon, painting everything orange and red. But the heat lingered. Enjoy it, Rose, I told myself. The colors, the taste of chocolate. Of course I'd always loved chocolate. My life didn't need to be on the line for me to enjoy dessert. We reached the cafe and found Sydney bent over her laptop, with a barely eaten Danish and what was probably her fourth cup of coffee. We slid into seats beside her. How's it? Hey, you are playing Minesweeper! I tried to peer closer at her screen, but she turned it from me. You're supposed to be finding a connection to Eric's mistress. I already did, she said simply. Dimitri and I exchanged astonished looks. But I don't know how useful it'll be. Anything will be useful, I proclaimed. What did you find? After trying to track down all those bank records and transactions, and let me tell you, that is not fun at all, I finally found a small piece of info. The bank account we have now is a newer one. It was moved from another bank about 5 years ago. The old account was still a Jane Doe, but it did have a next of kin reference in the event something happened to the account holder. I could hardly breathe. Financial transactions were lost on me, but we were about to get something solid. A real name? Sydney nodded. Sonia Karp. Chapter 12. Dimitri and I both froze as the shock of that name hit us. Sydney, glancing between our faces, gave us a dry smile. I take it you know who that is? Of course, I exclaimed. She was my teacher. She went crazy and turned Strigoi. Sydney nodded. I know. My eyes widened further. She's not the one who had an affair with Lissa's dad, is she? Oh, dear God. That would be one of the most unexpected developments in the roller coaster that was my life. I couldn't even begin to process the effects of that. Not likely, she said. The account was opened several years before she was added as the beneficiary, which was right when she turned 18. So if we're assuming the account was created around the time the baby was born, then she would have been way too young. Sonia's probably a relative. My earlier astonishment was giving way to excitement, and I could see the same thing happening to Dimitri.
You must have records about her family, he said. Or if not, Sumroy probably does. Who's close to Sonia? Does she have a sister?
Sydney shook her head. No, that'd be an obvious choice, though. Unfortunately, she has other family. Tons of it. Her parents both came from giant families, so she has lots of cousins. Even some of her aunts are the right age. We can look them up, right? I asked. A thrill of anticipation was running through me. I honestly hadn't expected this much information. True, it was small, but it was something. If Sonia Karp was related to Eric's mistress, that had to be something we could track. There's a lot of them, Sydney shrugged. I mean, yeah, we could. It'd take a long time to find everyone's life history, and even then, especially if this was covered up enough, we'd have a hard time finding out if any of them is the woman we're looking for, or even if any of them know who she is. Dimitri's voice was low and thoughtful when he spoke.
One person knows who Jane Doe is.
Sydney and I both looked at him expectantly.
Sonia Karp, he replied.
I threw up my hands.
Yeah, but we can't talk to her. She's a lost cause. Mikhail Tanner spent over a year hunting her and couldn't find her. If he can't, then we're not going to be able to. Dmitri turned away from me and stared out the window, his brown eyes filled with sorrow, his thoughts momentarily far away from us. I didn't entirely understand what was happening, but that peaceful moment in the library, where Dmitri had smiled and shared in the daydream of an ordinary life, had vanished. And not just the moment. That Dmitri had vanished. He was back in his fierce mode, carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders again. At last, he sighed and looked back at me.
That's because Mikhail didn't have the right connections.
Mikhail was her boyfriend, I pointed out. He had more connections than anyone else. Dmitri didn't acknowledge my comment. Instead, he grew pensive again. I could see turmoil behind his eyes. Some inner war. At last, it must have been decided.
Does your phone have reception out here?
He asked her. She nodded, reaching into her purse and handing him her phone. He held it a moment, looking like it caused him total agony to touch it. At last, with another sigh, he stood up and headed for the door. Sydney and I exchanged questioning looks and then both followed him. She lagged behind me, having to toss cash on the table and grab her laptop. I emerged outside just as Dmitri finished dialing a number and put the phone to his ear. Sydney joined us, and a moment later, the person on the other end of the line must have answered.
Boris?
Asked Dmitri. That was all I understood because the rest was a string of rapid Russian. A strange sensation spread over me as he spoke. I was confused, lost because of the language. But there was more than that. I felt chilled, my pulse raced with fear. That voice. I knew that voice. It was his voice and yet not his voice. It was the voice of my nightmares, a voice of coldness and cruelty. Dmitri was playing Strigoi. Well, playing was really too gentle of a word. Pretending was a better way to describe it. Whatever it was pretty damned convincing. Beside me, Sydney frowned, but I didn't think she was experiencing what I was. She had never known him as a Strigoi. She didn't have those horrible memories. His change in demeanor had to be obvious, but as I glanced at her face, I realized she was focused on following the conversation. I'd forgotten she knew Russian. "What's he saying?" I whispered. Her frown deepened, either from the conversation or me distracting her. He sounds like he's talking to someone he hasn't spoken to in a while. Dmitri's accusing this person of slacking off while he's been away. She fell silent, continuing her own mental translation. At one point, Dmitri's voice rose in anger, and both Sydney and I flinched. I turned to her questioningly. He's mad about having his authority questioned. I can't tell, but now it sounds like the other person's groveling. I wanted to know every word, but it had to be hard for her to translate to me and listen at the same time. Dmitri's voice returned to normal levels, though still filled with that terrible menace, and among the flurry of words I heard Sonia Karp and Montana. He's asking about Miss Karp. Sonia? I murmured. She hadn't been my teacher for a long time. I might as well call her Sonia now. Yeah, said Sydney, eyes still on Dmitri. He's asking, telling this person to locate someone else and see if he can find Sonia. This person... She paused to listen again. This person he's asking about sounds like he knows a lot of people in the area she was last seen in. I knew people in this context meant Strigoi. Dmitri had risen quickly in their ranks, asserting his will and power over others. Most Strigoi operated solo, rarely working in groups. But even the lone ones recognized threats and more dominant Strigoi. Dmitri was working his contacts, just as he'd said earlier. If any Strigoi had heard about his transformation,
and believed it, they wouldn't have been able to pass the news quickly, not with their disorganization. As it was, Dmitri was already having to play leapfrog to find sources who knew other sources who might know Sonia's location. Dmitri grew loud and angry again, his voice becoming, if possible, more sinister. I suddenly felt trapped, and even Sydney looked scared now. She swallowed. He's telling this guy that if he doesn't get answers by tomorrow night, Dimitri's going to find him and rip him apart and... Sydney didn't bother finishing. Her eyes were wide. Use your imagination. It's pretty terrible. I decided then that I was kind of glad I hadn't heard all of the conversation in English. When Dmitri finished the call and returned Sydney's phone, that mask of malice melted from his face. Once again, he was my Dmitri. Dmitri the Dompierre. Dejection and despair radiated off him, and he slumped against the cafe's wall, staring upward into the sky. I knew what he was doing. He was trying to calm himself, seize control of the emotions that had to be warring within him. He'd just done something that might give us clues we needed. But it had been at a terrible cost to himself. My fingers twitched. I wanted to put a comforting arm around him or at least pat his shoulder so he'd know he wasn't alone. But I held back, suspecting he wouldn't like it. At last, he turned his gaze back to us. He'd regained his control, at least on the outside.
I've sent someone asking about her, he said wearily. It might not work out. Strogoi are hardly the type to keep a database, but they do occasionally keep an eye on one another. If only for their own self-preservation, we'll find out soon if there are any hits.
Wow, thank you, I said, fumbling at the words. I knew he needed no thanks, but it felt necessary to me. He nodded.
We should get back to the Keepers, unless you think this is a safe place to stay.
I'd rather stay off civilized radar, said Sydney, moving toward the truck. Besides, I want my car keys back. The ride back felt 10 times longer. Dimitri's mood filled up the whole cabin, almost suffocating us with its despair. Even Sydney could feel it. She'd let him drive again, and I couldn't decide if that was a good or bad thing. Would the road distract him from his Strogoi torment? Or would his agony distract him from the road and put us off in a ditch? Fortunately, we made it back safe and sound and found 2 of the keepers waiting for us in the lot, a Maroi woman and a human guy who both looked fierce. I still couldn't shake the strangeness of both races being battle-ready. I wondered if these 2 were a couple. Back in the camp, we found the communal bonfire ablaze and people sitting out around it, some eating and some just socializing. I'd learned at breakfast that the fire was always there for those who wanted to bond, but that plenty of families kept to their own households as well. We went back to Raymond's house, but only Sarah and Joshua were there. She was cleaning up dishes, and he sat restlessly in a chair. As soon as he caught sight of me at the door, he sprang up, radiant smile on high beam again.
Rose, you're back. We were starting to worry. I mean... not that anything had happened to you, not with your skills, but that maybe you'd just left us.
Not without our car, said Sydney, placing the truck keys on the table. The CRVs were sitting there already, and relief flooded her face as she snatched them up. Sarah offered us leftovers, which we declined, having stocked up on snack food at Rubiesville's gas station.
Well, she said, if you're not going to eat, you might as well join the others out at the fire. Jess McHale might sing tonight if they can get her to drink enough. And drunk or sober, that woman has the finest voice I've ever heard.
I briefly met Dmitri in Sydney's eyes. I admit, I was a little curious to see how this wilderness group partied it up, even though moonshine and folk songs weren't really my first choice of entertainment. Dmitri still wore that haunted look from the phone call.
I had a suspicion he would have been content to isolate himself in our room. But when Sydney said she'd go to the fire, his response came automatically.
I'll go too.
I knew instantly what he was doing. His Strigoi days tormented him. Talking to Strigoi tormented him. And maybe? No, certainly. He wanted to hide away and try to block it all out. But he was Dimitri. Dimitri protected those who needed it. And even if listening to fireside songs wasn't exactly life-threatening, it was still a semi-dangerous situation for a civilian like Sydney. He couldn't allow that. Plus, he knew Sydney would feel safer with both of us nearby. I started to say I'd join them, but Joshua spoke before I could.
Do you still want to see my cave? There's a little light left outside. You'll get a better view that way than if we have to use a torch.
I'd forgotten about my last conversation with Joshua and started to decline his offer. But then, something flashed in Dimitri's eyes, something disapproving. So, he didn't want me going off with some young, good-looking guy. Was it legitimate concern about the keepers? Was it jealousy? No, surely not the latter. We'd established, many, many times, that Dimitri wanted no romantic connection with me. He'd even stood up for Adrian earlier. Was this some kind of ex-boyfriend thing? Back in Rubiesville, I'd believed Dimitri and I could be friends. But that wouldn't happen if he thought he could control me and my love life. I'd known girls with exes like that. I wouldn't be one. I could hang out with whomever I wanted. Sure, I said. Dimitri's expression darkened. I'd love to. Joshua and I headed off, leaving the others behind. I knew part of my decision was to prove my independence. Dimitri had said we were equals. Yet he'd made an awful lot of decisions in this escape plan without me. It was nice to feel like I had the upper hand for a change. And besides, I liked Joshua, and was kind of curious to learn more about how his people lived. I don't think Sydney wanted me to leave, but Dimitri would look after her. As Joshua and I walked, we passed plenty of keepers out and about. Just like earlier, I received a fair amount of stares. Rather than lead us down the road to where his father lived, Joshua took me around the small mountain. It was still good-sized, but after living near the Rockies, everything in the Appalachians seemed small to me. I guess I was a mountain snob. Still, the mountain extended quite a ways, and we moved farther and farther from the keeper's main settlement. The forest grew thicker, the light growing scarce as the sun finally began sinking into the horizon.
I'm kind of on the outskirts,
Joshua said apologetically.
We keep growing and growing, and there's not much room in the town center.
I thought town was an optimistic term, but didn't say so. Yeah, I was definitely a snob.
But the caves keep going, so there's still space.
Are they natural? I asked.
Some are. Some are abandoned mining caves.
It's pretty out here, I said. I liked all the deciduous trees. I might be homesick for Montana, but the wide leaves here were a neat contrast to pine needles. And hey, at least you get lots of privacy, right?
True,
he smiled.
I figured you'd think it was, I don't know, too rustic or savage. You probably think we all are.
His observation startled me. Most of the keepers had been so fiercely defensive of their way of life that I hadn't thought anyone would even think an outsider would question it, or that any keeper would care if we did. It's just different, I said diplomatically. A lot different from what I'm used to. I felt a flash of homesickness for all the people and places I was now cut off from. Lissa, Adrian, our other friends, Court, St. Vladimir's. I shook the feeling off quickly. I had no time to mope and could at least check on Lissa later.
I've been to human towns, continued Joshua, and other places the tainted live. I can see why you'd like them.
He turned a bit sheepish.
I wouldn't mind electricity.
Why don't you guys use it?
We would if we could. We're just too far out. And no one really knows we're here anyway. The Lily people say it's better for hiding us.
It hadn't occurred to me that they simply endured these conditions because they were forced to in order to conceal themselves. I wondered how many of their choices came from clinging to the so-called old ways, and how much was influenced by the alchemists.
Here we are,
said Joshua, pulling me from my musings. He gestured to a dark hole at ground level. The opening was big enough for an adult to enter.
Nice, I said.
I'd noticed earlier that some of the caves were set higher into the mountains, and had watched their residents either climb the rock bare-handed or use homemade ladders. An easy-access doorway seemed luxurious. Joshua looked surprised at my praise.
Really?
Really. We'd ended up losing too much daylight. He paused to light a torch, and then I followed him inside. We had to duck a little at first, but as we went deeper into the cave, the ceiling slowly expanded and opened up into a wide, rounded space. The floor was hard-packed dirt, the stone walls rough and jagged. This was a natural cave, but I could pick out the efforts made to civilize it. The floor had been cleaned and leveled, and I saw some stones and rocks in a corner that looked like they'd been gathered up to clear space. A couple pieces of furniture had already been moved in. A narrow wooden chair and a mattress that looked like it could barely hold one person.
You probably think it's small, said Joshua.
It was true, but it was actually bigger than my dorm room at St. Vladimir's.
Well, yeah, but I mean, how old are you?
18.
Same as me, I said. This seemed to make him pretty happy.
Having your own, cave at 18 is pretty cool. It would have been cooler still with electricity, internet, and plumbing, but there was no need to bring that up. His blue eyes practically shone. I couldn't help but notice what a pretty contrast they made against his tanned skin. I dismissed the thought immediately. I wasn't here for a boyfriend, but apparently I was the only one who believed that. Joshua suddenly took a step forward.
You can stay if you want, he said. The other tainted would never find you here. We could get married, and then when we had kids, we could build a loft like my parents and...
The word married had me moving toward the entrance as shocked and panicked as I would be by a Strigoi attack. Except, I usually had fair warning before those.
Whoa, whoa, slow down.
No, I hadn't seen a proposal coming.
We just met!
Thankfully, he didn't come closer.
I know, but sometimes that's how it is.
What, marriages between people who hardly know each other? I asked incredulously.
Sure, happens all the time. And seriously, just in this short a time, I already know I like you. You're amazing. You're beautiful and obviously a good fighter. And the way you carry yourself.
He shook his head, awe on his face.
I've never seen anything like it.
I wished he wasn't so cute and nice. Having creepy guys profess their adoration was a lot easier to deal with than one you liked. I remembered Sydney saying I was a hot commodity here. Scorching was more like it, apparently. Joshua, I really like you, but... I added hastily, seeing hope fill his features. I'm too young to get married. He frowned.
Didn't you say you were 18?
Okay. Age was probably not a good argument around here. I'd seen how young people had kids back in Dimitri's hometown. In a place like this, they probably had child marriages. I tried another angle. I don't even know if I want to get married. This didn't faze him. He nodded in understanding.
We could live together first. See how we get along.
His serious expression turned back into a smile.
But I'm pretty easygoing. I'd let you win every argument.
I couldn't help it. I laughed.
Well then, I'm going to have to win this one and tell you I'm just not ready for any of it. Besides, I'm already involved with someone.
Dimitri?
No, another guy. He's back at the tainted court. I couldn't even believe I was saying that. Joshua frowned.
Why isn't he here protecting you, then?
Because that's not how he is, and I can take care of myself. I'd never liked the assumption that I needed rescuing. And look, even if he wasn't in the picture, I'm leaving soon anyway. It would never work out between you and me.
I understand.
Joshua looked disappointed, but seemed to be taking the rejection okay.
Maybe when you've got everything sorted out, you'll come back.
I started to tell him not to wait for me, and that he should just marry someone else, despite how ridiculous it was at his age. But then I realized that was a pointless comment. In Joshua's fantasies, he could probably marry someone else now, and then add me onto his harem later, like Sarah and Paulette. So I just simply said, maybe. Groping for a change in subject, I searched for anything to distract us. My eyes fell on the chair and the leafy pattern carved into it. That's really neat.
Thanks,
he said, walking over. To my relief, he didn't pursue the earlier topic. He ran his hand lovingly over the ornately carved wood. The design looked like braided leaves.
I did it myself.
Really? I asked in true surprise. That's amazing.
If you like it.
His hand moved, and I feared there was a kiss or embrace coming. Instead, he reached into his shirt pocket and produced a finely carved wooden bracelet. It was a simple, sinuous design, the true marvel being how narrow and delicate it was to all be one piece. The wood had been polished to brilliance.
Here.
He handed me the bracelet. This is for me? I ran my finger along the smooth edge.
If you want it, I made it while you're out today, so you'll remember me after you leave.
I hesitated, wondering if accepting this would be encouraging him. No, I decided. I'd made my views on teenage marriage clear. And anyway, he looked so nervous, I couldn't stand the thought of hurting his feelings. I slipped it onto my wrist. Of course I'll remember. Thank you. From the happy look on his face, taking the bracelet made up for my earlier refusal, he showed me a few more details around the cave and then followed my suggestion to join the others at the fire. We could hear the music echoing through the trees long before we made it back, and while it was hardly my style, there was something warm and friendly about this community's way of life. I'd never been to summer camp, but I imagined this was what it'd be like. Sydney and Dimitri sat near the group's edge. They were quiet and watchful, but everyone else sang, clapped, and talked. Again, I was stunned at how easily Dompierre's humans and Maroi could all be involved with one another. Mixed couples were everywhere. And one, a human and Maroi, were openly making out. Every so often when he kissed her neck, he'd also bite and take some blood. I had to glance away. I turned back toward my friends. Sydney noticed me and looked relieved. Dimitri's expression was unreadable. Like always, the other's eyes followed my movement, and to my surprise, I saw open jealousy on some of the guys' faces. I hoped they didn't think Joshua and I had been off getting naked in the cave. That was hardly the reputation I wanted to leave behind. I have to talk to Sydney, I told him over the noise. I decided it'd be best to keep my distance before any rumors started, and truthfully, Sydney looked like she wanted me by her side. Joshua nodded, and I turned away. I'd taken two steps when a fist suddenly came right toward my face. I'd had no defenses up and just barely had the presence of mind to turn my head and catch the blow on my cheek, rather than end up with a broken nose. After the initial surprise, all my training kicked in. I quickly sidestepped out of the line of attack and put my body into a fighter stance. The music and singing stopped, and I turned to face my attacker. Angeline. She stood in a way similar to my own, fists clenched and eyes completely honed in on me.
Okay, she said.
It's time to find out how tough you really are. What it was time for was someone, say like a parent, to come and drag her off and punish her for punching guests. Amazingly, no one moved or tried to stop her. No, that wasn't quite true. One person stood up. Dimitri had sprung to action the instant he saw me in danger. I expected him to come pull Angeline away, but a group of keepers hastily moved to his side, saying something to him that I couldn't hear. They didn't try to physically restrain him, but whatever they said, it kept him where he stood. I would have demanded to know what they'd told him, but Angeline was coming at me again. It looked like I was on my own. Angeline was short, even for a Dampier, but her whole body was packed with strength. She was pretty fast, too, though not fast enough to get that second hit in on me. I neatly dodged it and kept my distance, not wanting to go on the offensive at this girl. She could probably do a fair amount of damage in a fight, but there was a sloppy, no, more like rough, edge to it. She was a scrapper, someone who'd done a lot of brawling but without any formal training. "Are you insane?" I exclaimed, moving out of the way of another assault. "Stop this. I don't want to hurt you." "Sure," she said. "That's what you want everyone to think, right? If you don't actually have to fight, then they'll all go on believing those marks are real." "They are real." The insinuation that I'd faked my tattoos sparked my temper, but I refused to get drawn into this ridiculous scuffle. "Prove it," she said, coming at me again. "Prove you're who you say you are." It was like a dance, keeping away from her. I could have done it all night, and a few dismayed cries from the crowd demanded we get on with it. "I don't have to prove anything," I told her. "It's a lie, then." Her breathing was heavy now. She was working a lot harder than me. "Everything you tainted do is a lie." "Not true," I said. Why was Dimitri letting this go on? Out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of him, and so help me, he was smiling. Meanwhile, Angeline was still continuing her tirade as she tried to hit me. "You all lie. You're all weak, especially your royals. They're the worst of all." "You don't know them at all. You don't know anything about them." She might be able to carry on a conversation, but I could see her growing increasingly frustrated. If not for the fact I was pretty sure she'd hit me in the back, I would have taken the noble approach and simply walked away. "I know enough," she said. "I know they're selfish and spoiled and don't do anything for themselves. They don't care about anyone else. They're all the same." I actually agreed with Angeline about some royals, but didn't like the generalization. "Don't talk about things you don't understand," I snapped. "They're not all like that." "They are," she said, pleased to see me angry. "I wish they were all dead." It was hardly enough to push me into offense mode, but the comment did cloud my thoughts enough that I let her get through my guard, just a little. I never would have let that happen with a Strigoi, but I'd underestimated this wild girl. Her legs snaked out just enough to hit my knee, and it was like tossing a spark into gasoline. Everything exploded. With that hit, I stumbled slightly, and she pushed her advantage. My battle instincts took over, and I had no choice but to strike back before she could hit me. People began cheering now that the fight was really going. I was on offense, trying to subdue her, meaning the physical contact had jumped up exponentially. I was still better than her, no doubt, but in trying to get to her, I put myself in her range. She landed a few blows on me, nothing serious, before I was able to tackle her to the ground. I expected that to be the end, but she pushed back against me before I could fully restrain her. We rolled over, and she tried to take the dominant position. I couldn't allow that, and managed a punch on the side of her face that was a lot harder than the earlier one. I thought that would be the end of the fight. My hit had knocked her off me, and I started to stand. But then that little bitch grabbed my hair and jerked me back down. I twisted out of her hold, though I'm pretty sure she took some hair away with her, and this time managed to fully pin her, throwing all my weight and strength into it as I pressed down. I knew it had to be painful, but didn't really care. She'd started it. Besides, this skirmish had gone beyond defense. Pulling someone's hair was just plain dirty. Angeline made a few more attempts to break away,
but when it became clear she couldn't, those around us began whistling and cheering. A few moments later, that dark and furious look vanished from Angeline's face, replaced by resignation. I eyed her warily, not about to let down my guard.
"Fine," she said. "I guess it's okay. Go ahead."
"Huh? What's okay?" I demanded.
"It's okay if you marry my brother."
Chapter 13.
"It's not funny."
"You're right," agreed Sydney. "It's not funny. It's hilarious."
We were back at Raymond's house in the privacy of our room. It had taken forever for us to get away from the fireside festivities, particularly after learning a terrible fact about a keeper custom. Well, I thought it was terrible, at least. It turned out that if someone wanted to marry someone else around here, the prospective bride and groom each had to battle it out with the other's nearest relative of the same sex. Angeline had spotted Joshua's interest from the moment I'd arrived, and when she'd seen the bracelet, she'd assumed that some sort of arrangement had been made. It therefore fell on her, as his sister, to make sure I was worthy. She still didn't like or entirely trust me, but proving myself a capable fighter had shot me up in her esteem, allowing her to consent to our engagement. It had then taken a lot of fast talking to convince everyone, including Joshua, that there was no engagement. Had there been, I'd learned, Dimitri would have had to stand in as my relative and fight Joshua.
"Stop that," I chastised.
Dimitri leaned against one of the room's walls, arms crossed, watching as I rubbed where Angeline had hit my cheekbone. It was hardly the worst injury I'd ever had, but I'd definitely have a bruise tomorrow. There was a small smile on his face.
"I told you not to encourage him,"
came Dimitri's calm response.
"Whatever, you didn't see this coming. You just didn't want me to..."
I bit off my words. I wouldn't say what was on my mind, that Dimitri was jealous. Or possessive. Or whatever. I just knew he'd been irritated to see me friendly with Joshua, and very amused at my outrage over Angeline's attack. I abruptly turned to Sydney, who was just as entertained as Dimitri. In fact, I was pretty sure I'd never seen her smile so much.
"Did you know about this custom?"
"No,"
she admitted.
"But I'm not surprised. I told you they're savage. A lot of ordinary problems are settled by fights like that."
"It's stupid," I said, not caring that I was whining. I touched the top of my head, wishing I had a mirror to see if Angeline had taken a noticeable chunk of hair. Although, she wasn't bad. Unpolished, but not bad. Are they all that tough? The humans and Maroi, too?
"That's my understanding."
I pondered that. I was annoyed and embarrassed by what had happened, but I had to admit the keepers were suddenly way more interesting. How ironic that such a backward group had the insight to teach everyone to fight, no matter their race. Meanwhile, my own enlightened culture still refused to teach defense. "And that's why Strigoi don't bother them," I murmured, recalling breakfast. I didn't even realize what I'd said until Dimitri's smile dropped. He glanced toward the window, face grim.
"I should check in with Boris again and see what he's found."
He turned back toward Sydney.
"It won't take long. We don't all need to go. Should I just take your car since I only have to go a little ways?"
She shrugged and reached for her keys. We learned earlier that Sydney's phone could pick up a signal about 10 minutes from the village. He was right. There really was no reason for us all to go for a quick phone call. After my fight, Sydney and I were reasonably safe. No one would mess with me now. Still, I didn't like the thought of Dimitri reliving his Strigoi days alone.
"You should still go," I told her, thinking fast. "I need to check in on Lyssa."
Not entirely a lie. What my friends had heard from Joe was still weighing on me.
"I can usually still keep track of what's going on around me at the same time, but it might be better if you're away, especially in case alchemists do show up." My logic was faulty, though her colleagues were still a concern. I doubt they'd come while it's dark, she said. But I don't really want to hang out if you're just going to stare into space. She didn't admit it, and I didn't need to say anything, but I suspected she didn't want someone else driving her car anyway. Dimitri thought her coming was unnecessary and said as much, but apparently he didn't feel like he could boss her around as much as me. So they both set out, leaving me alone in the room. I watched them wistfully. Despite how annoying his earlier mockery had been, I was worried about him. I'd seen the effect of the last call and wished I could be there now to comfort him. I had a feeling he wouldn't have allowed that. So I accepted Sydney's accompaniment as a small victory. With them gone, I decided I really would check in with Lissa. I'd said it more as an excuse, but truthfully, it beat the alternative. Going back out and socializing. I didn't want any more people congratulating me. And apparently Joshua had read my maybe and acceptance of the bracelet as a real commitment. I still thought he was devastatingly cute, but couldn't handle seeing his adoration. Sitting cross-legged on Angeline's bed, I opened myself to the bond and what Lissa was experiencing. She was walking through the halls of a building I didn't recognize at first. A moment later, I got my bearings. It was a building at court that housed a large spa and salon, as well as the hideout of Rhonda the Gypsy. It seemed weird that Lissa would be going to get her fortune told, but once I got a glimpse of her companions, I knew she was up to something else. The usual suspects were with her, Adrian and Christian. My heart leapt at seeing Adrian again, especially after the Joshua incident. My last spirit dream had been too brief. Christian was holding Lissa's hand as they walked, his grip warm and reassuring. He looked confident and determined, though with that typically snarky half-smile of his. Lissa was the one who felt nervous and was clearly bracing herself for something. I could feel her dreading her next task, even though she believed it was necessary. "Is this it?" she asked, coming to a halt in front of a door.
"I think so," said Christian. "That receptionist said it was the red one."
Lissa hesitated only a moment and then knocked. Nothing. Either the room was empty or she was being ignored. She held up her hand again and the door opened. Ambrose stood there, stunning as always, even in jeans and a casual blue t-shirt. The clothing hugged his body in a way that showed off every muscle. He could have walked straight off the cover of GQ.
"Hey,"
he said, clearly surprised. "Hey," said Lissa back. "We were wondering if we could talk to you." Ambrose, ever so slightly, inclined his head toward the room.
"I'm kind of busy right now."
Beyond him, Lissa could see a massage table with a Maroi woman lying face down. The lower half of her body had a towel over it, but her back was bare, shining in the dim lighting with oil. Scented candles burned in the room, and a calming kind of New Age music played softly.
"Wow," said Adrian. "You don't waste any time, do you? She's only been in a grave a few hours, and you've already got someone new."
Tatiana had finally been laid to rest earlier in the day, just before sunset. The burial had had much less fanfare than the original attempt. Ambrose gave Adrian a sharp look.
"She's my client. It's my job. You forget that some of us have to work for a living."
"Please?" asked Lissa, hastily stepping in front of Adrian. "It won't take long." Ambrose looked my friends over a moment and then sighed. He glanced behind him.
"Lorraine, I have to step outside. I'll be right back, okay?"
"Okay," called the woman. She shifted, facing him. She was older than I'd expected, mid-40s or so. I guess if you were paying for a massage, there was no reason not to have a masseuse half your age.
"Hurry back."
He gave her a dazzling smile as he shut the door, a smile that dropped once he was alone with my friends.
"Okay, what's going on? I don't like the looks on your faces."
Ambrose might have radically deviated from a Dompierre man's normal life, but he'd had the same training as any guardian. He was observant. He was always on the lookout for potential threats.
We, wanted to talk to you about...
Lissa hesitated. Talking about investigations and interrogations was one thing. Carrying them out was another.
About Tatiana's murder.
Ambrose's eyebrows rose.
Ah, I see. Not sure what there is to say, except that I don't think Rose did it. I don't think you believe that either, despite what's going around. Everyone's talking about how shocked and upset you are. You're getting a lot of sympathy over having been tricked by such a dangerous and sinister friend.
Lissa felt her cheeks flush. By publicly condemning me and renouncing our friendship, Lissa was keeping herself out of trouble. It had been Abe and Tasha's advice, and Lissa knew it was sound. Yet, even though it was an act, she still felt guilty. Christian stepped to her defense.
Back off. That's not what this is about.
What is it about, then? Asked Ambrose. Lissa jumped in, worried Christian and Adrian might upset Ambrose and make it difficult to get answers.
Abe Mazur told us that in the courtroom you said, or, did something to Rose.
Ambrose looked shocked, and I had to give him points for being convincing.
Did something? What does that mean? Does Mazur think I, like, hit on her in front of all those people?
I don't know, admitted Lissa. He just saw something, that's all.
I wished her good luck,
said Ambrose, still looking offended.
Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Lissa had made a point to talk to Ambrose before Abe could, fearing Abe's methods would involve threats and a lot of physical force. Now she was wondering if she was doing so great a job.
Look, we're just trying to find out who really killed the Queen. You were close to her. If there's anything, anything at all you've got that can help us, we'd appreciate it. We need it.
Ambrose glanced curiously between them. Then he suddenly understood.
You think I did it! That's what this is about!
None of them said anything.
I can't believe this! I already got this from the Guardians, but from you? I thought you knew me better. We don't know you at all, said Adrian flatly. All we know is you had lots of access to my aunt.
He pointed at the door.
And obviously, it didn't take you long to move on. Did you miss the part where I said that's my job? I'm giving her a massage, that's it. Not everything is sordid and dirty.
Ambrose shook his head in frustration and ran a hand through his brown hair.
My relationship with Tatiana wasn't dirty either. I cared about her. I would never do anything to hurt her. Don't statistics say most murders happen between close people?
Asked Christian. Lissa glared at him and Adrian.
Stop it, both of you!
She looked back at Ambrose.
No one's accusing you of anything. But you were around her a lot, and Rose told me you were upset about the age law.
When I first heard about it, yeah,
Ambrose said.
And even then, I told Rose there was some mistake, that there must be something we didn't know. Tatiana would have never put those Dompierres in danger without a good reason. Like making herself look good in front of all those terrified royals?
Asked Christian.
Watch it,
warned Adrian. Lissa couldn't decide which was more annoying, her two guys teaming up to spar against Ambrose or them throwing barbs at each other.
No!
Ambrose's voice rang through the narrow hall.
She didn't want to do that. But if she didn't, worse things were going to happen. There are people who wanted, still want, to round up all the Dompierres who don't fight and force them into it. Tatiana passed the age law as a way to stall that.
Silence fell. I'd already learned this from Tatiana's note, but it was shocking news to my friends. Ambrose kept going, seeing he was gaining ground.
She was actually open to lots of other options. She wanted to explore spirit. She approved of Maroi learning to fight.
That got a reaction from Adrian. He still wore that sardonic expression, but I could also see faint lines